From beanies to carry bags and from shoes to caps, browse our shop now at tntradio.live. TNT. You're with Jeremy Nell on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Jim Wolfe at tntradio.live. That's my email address. Send me an email. Let me know where in the world you are. I am a little under the weather. I was having a nap earlier. Thankfully, I didn't miss my show. But I'm going to insist that Matt, who's going to be joining me in a moment, is going to do lots of talking. I'll just sit back and listen. It's a fascinating topic. I love chatting to Matt. So I'd rather be here and stick it out with Alex. You know, Alex, have you seen that photograph, that official crown photo of King Charles, the first one that they released? He looks like an old retired lesbian school teacher who goes to the football on weekends. It's the most ridiculous photo. I just can't get over it. I'm a fan of monarchies in general, more so than democracies. But that's a very complicated conversation, and I don't mean that in the modern sense. The British monarchy is certainly not an example of a monarchy that I'm referring to. I don't think there are any, in the year 2023. But it's more a academic conversation, and if you are interested in thinking a bit along those lines, I'd recommend a great book that I've recommended a few times. It's called Democracy, the God That Failed by Hans Hermann Hoppe. And he makes a very, very strong case for why democracy is inferior to monarchy, but he doesn't make the case for monarchy either. But it's just really, really interesting. As academic or thought experiments go, I'd strongly recommend it. Basically, in a nutshell, it's monarchy is essentially the most skilled people at the top, whereas democracy, it's not. It's whoever has the best marketing campaign. And then the masses, you know, the peasant class essentially choose who their next leader of the economy is going to be for the next few years. That's a very crude way of looking at it, and I suppose it's a lot more nuanced than that. But give the book a read, Democracy, the God That Failed, Hans Hermann Hoppe. It's on Amazon. All right. Let's get to Matt. My name is Jim. This is Jim Warfare, the Battle of Ideas.
Unbiased and reliable news coverage.
It's the news I trust.
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Matt Errett, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back, Jeremy.
I think I created a bit of a segue there for you.
Yes, you did. You're very good at that. You opened up a door to a very deep conversation on an academic level that is very close to my heart, but I don't want to deflect into academic philosophy about monarchy, democracy, republicanism, and meritocracy, which I do want to do, and maybe we can weave that in at some point. I know that we wanted to talk about something a little bit more practical.
The retired lesbian school teacher.
The retired lesbian school teacher. Yes. Yes, that was a weird little phenomenon that we were forced to encounter. Even people trying to avoid it couldn't really fully avoid the pageantry that was blared across all of the mainstream media, radio, television, every talking head, showcasing the pomp and gala that was the coronation of King Charles III, former Prince of Wales, inbred. Son of two folks who are cousins, grandchildren of Queen Victoria, the spider woman who just sort of produced a lot of inbred children all over Europe, who went to war and ripped each other to shreds in World War I. And somehow you've got this weird nest, this weird thing of these hereditary institutions in Europe that people have been told, and I'm in Canada. You know, you're in South Africa. We represent two different parts of the Commonwealth. People amongst the Commonwealth are told that these are, nice traditional memories that we should pay respect to and homage to, that are maybe they're a little bit relics of a bygone age, but they're really, really respectable and otherwise just symbolic, you know, or way to pay homage to tradition, but having no real impact on the current world we live in. And in the course of my recent book on the clash of the two Americas, the Anglo-Venetian roots of the deep state, and the new essay that I published in honor of Charles III, I tried to debunk some of those mythologies that the British Empire is a thing of the past with no actual power. And I did a summary deep dive as much as I could into both Charles the individual, what role he plays, what powers he wields, both as prince and now as king, and the crown more broadly. So what is the crown more broadly as an institution that is above the individuals who happen to at any given moment occupy the throne? You know, individuals come and go, but the crown is a little bit more pervasive as an institution. And also, what is the broader British Empire? What was it? In such, you know, I tried to just treat how the idea that the British Empire disappeared after World War II is also a giant mythology. It is not true. And when you look at the techniques, the primary controlling nodes of international empire today, both from the standpoint of the control, the deployment of terrorist activity, which is not an organic sociological phenomenon that just arises by itself because people hate freedoms, but rather is an artificial construct created, cultivated, incubated, and deployed for very specific geopolitical effects. One can't understand anything about terrorism internationally or even domestic if one doesn't look at the active role of the British Empire today, as far as an international deep state. What about the drug money laundering, the money laundering operations in British Cayman Islands, operations, offshore banking, which is all British Commonwealth territory, that about 95% of the international drug money laundering, other forms of money laundering operations occur. What about mining interests exploiting Africa and much of South America and the poorest parts of the world? How does British mining, British controlled mining, either in London or in South Africa or in Canada, play a major role in keeping the people of the world as poor and exploited as possible? So it's a multifaceted thing. And I tried to just, again, do this in a summary way that gives people the essentials that they need to understand to comprehend how the oligarchical mechanisms, which also bring in the Great Reset and Charles's role as a co-architect of the Great Reset, how this is all shaping the world today.
South Africa is quite important. Well, it used to be quite important to the crown because of the diamonds and the minerals.
That is correct.
There was a call recently for the main, what's it, that main jewel, the main diamond, to be brought back to South Africa, but that'll never happen.
No. No, is that the jewel that's in the
yes,
the crown?
Yeah.
Okay.
So that was
I don't know. I mean, okay. Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, it might happen down the line. It's the British are not going to part ways with a lot of these things that they've stolen from their the various colonies of the world, whether India, whether the Greek, you know, the British museums are replete with ancient Greek statuary that was looted under British imperial manipulation of Greece over the years. They might be forced, I hope, in the coming generations to give these things back. But again, I don't see it happening without a bunch of oligarchs kicking and screaming, because it forces them to admit certain truths that they would rather be kept under the rug about the abuses. And the abuses of the British Empire and what was done to the world and is being done to the world. If they did, you know, apologize and give these things back. So no, I don't necessarily see that.
So what you're telling me though, is that the crown is not just ceremonial. It actually still has significant global influence.
Yeah. Yeah. The crown itself is managed by something that people could Google if they would like to. There's something known as crown agents, as an emanation of the Crown. It's a semi-private organization, and people could Google Crown Agents Limited and look at the activities of this international hive operating all over the world, with a highly disproportionate amount of these branches active in Africa, Central and East Europe, Myanmar, Asia, India, Japan, South America. There's branch offices in the United States. They were set up in 1833 as a function of the British Colonial Office, which interfaced very closely with the British East India Company, which was sort of the muscles maintaining the empire around the world. So Crown Agents Limited is something which receives funding from the World Bank, the UN, and specifically the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. In the United States branch offices, they're enmeshed with U.S. aid. And they manage the energy systems of Ukraine. They manage the healthcare deployment. They manage a lot of the COVID response protocols of the various parts of the world. This is a very ubiquitous organization. And again, they're basically one giant holding company with one singular owner in Southwark, England, known as the Crown Agents Foundation, otherwise very opaque. And they try to, you know, market themselves as this kind of cool, you know, they've got a cool branding that they're aiming for, but it's stiff. But people could see it. They can look at their website and see where they're active. But that's just one aspect of this thing. The other thing is, you know, the property, as far as the holdings of property, that's another aspect of the Crown. There's something known as the Crown Estate, which is one of the largest property, real estate property holders of Europe, of which 25% of their profits every year go to Charles directly. And they own, you know, like the Crown owns half of the offshore, the seabed all over the British Isles, which is one of the main beneficiaries of the Green New Deal for Europe that they're pushing. Will financially massively benefit, because if you want an offshore windmill or anything of the sort, you have to pay those who own the land where under the water where these things will go. And more broadly, you know, Charles, and this is maybe not as strategic, but it is useful to keep this in mind, that the Crown, the British Crown, is the largest property owner of the world, owning approximately 6.6 billion acres internationally. On top of what? Crown Corporation. Yeah, 6.6 billion acres is legally under the ownership of the Crown. This includes land in many of the Commonwealth countries. Like in Canada, it's something like 84% of the land in Canada is called legally Crown land. It's weird. We got Crown corporations like the Bank of Canada. A lot of Canadians think, oh, the Bank of Canada is a Crown corporation, so it's owned by the people. And it's like, no, it's really not. The name itself betrays who actually owns it. It's a Crown corporation. It's owned by the Crown. It's managed by Crown agents. These things are useful, and oftentimes the Crown doesn't need, like, you've got a well-run machine. The empire itself has many generations of management creating an invisible sort of mechanism, with lieutenant governors deployed, with governor generals deployed, with a very integrated shadow government of civil service, with deputy ministers in various parts of the Commonwealth, like in Canada. Many of the deputy ministers that operate out of the Privy Council office are not elected. They've never been elected, but they're enshrined within our Canadian Constitution, as part of British North America. And so these are systems that are highly integrated, that work very closely with the banking networks of the City of London, the City of London being still the center of world finance as a control center, a node, which is a square mile enshrined in the Magna Carta as having rights above any nation state, which cannot regulate or influence the desires and the behavior of the City of London. This is a part of the British Empire. It always was a part, even though in our history books we're not taught this. We're taught that the British Empire are just a bunch of like redcoats with funny hats, abusing natives. And it's so much more intricate. It's not just, that's the least important component of what the British Empire ever was. And so when you realize that it was always a banking empire, an empire of finance that interfaces very much with a revolving door policy, with insurance, with the various guilds, which manage the city of London. You know, the city of London itself has a private police force, a private judiciary. It's sort of a power unto itself. And again, it works very closely with the Bank of England as the world's first, or at least second, major private central bank that was used as a template later on for the establishment of central banks of following its model in America under the Federal Reserve and in various branches of the world, which all integrate and coordinate through the Bank of International Settlements, which was the major bank that was used to fund and prop up Hitler. These are all things which are integrated. They're not separate from the crown, but they're not the same thing either. And like, you know, what we found, for example, with King Charles today carrying on certain activities that were pioneered by his father, Prince Philip of Mountbatten, there are direct Nazi connections, like Prince Philip himself. And this is why I said the Bank of International Settlements, because the Bank of International Settlements was a Nazi bank. And I feel like we're coming close to a commercial break. I am, right? Okay, so let me just pull back.
Yes, we are. Yeah, all right. Okay, let's quickly do that. My name is Jerm. This is TNT Radio.
TNT Radio's Jesse Zurawell.
Let's start in Syria, where a few days ago, a military personnel was martyred and seven others, including two civilians, were injured in Israeli aggression targeting the vicinity of Aleppo City. The Israeli aggression also put Aleppo International Airport out of service, and Russia is doing nothing as per usual. What's your take?
We've talked about this multiple times, that Russia seems to be playing the role of actually hampering the ability of any country it associates with, at least in this region, to actually defend themselves and promote and project a campaign to recapture territories lost to the head-chopping maniacs that were hired by some of the same countries that are supposedly now going to open the door for Bashar al-Assad's government rehabilitation. Another big black mark on the role of Russia is whole campaign since 2015-2016.
Jesse Zurawell on today's News Talk TNT Radio.
Imagine the trauma of losing your child in a drowning. Did you know that up to 35 children a day drown in Vietnam? This shocking number of drownings happens because children are not taught how to swim or even to stay alive in water. And Vietnam is an amazingly wet place with water everywhere. Water Safety Vietnam has a mission to assist and significantly reduce the drowning toll in Vietnam and to further promote the opportunity for all Vietnamese children to learn water safety, swimming, and survival skills to survive in a range of aquatic environments. Water Safety Vietnam sends trained surf lifesavers to Vietnam to qualify school teachers as certified swim teachers on a train-the-trainer model. Thousands of school children have learned how to stay alive in water, and your support is needed to expand the impact of this program. Visit watersafetyvietnam.com and help make a difference today. A message brought to you by TNT Radio.
Today's news.
The sharing of biased and false news has become all too common on social media.
Everyone else checking facts first.
Unfortunately, some people think this is extremely dangerous to our democracy.
Free speech has a home on TNT Radio.
All right, Matt, carry on with what you were going to say before the break.
Right, yes. Well, I was just introducing a new variable. So we'd spoken a little bit about the ubiquity of the banking system, the City of London, the Bank of England as a private international central banking system. We spoke about crown agents. We spoke about the management of international terrorism. I just alluded to that a little bit. As far as how the British were able to cultivate the growth of things like the Muslim Brotherhood, of various operations through Saudi Arabia, which was again a nation set up by the British in the 1930s, around the same time that the British were consolidating the creation of Israel, which emerged out of a roundtable Fabian Society operation around Lord Balfour at the turn of the century. Even before that, you know, the first political Zionist was Lord Palmerston, Lord Shaftesbury. That set up in the 1840s the Palestinian Expedition Fund with the explicit intent of creating an Israeli state eventually to absorb the various Orthodox Jews of Europe and specifically Russia, into a zone that could be then manipulated and lit on fire for the benefit of an imperial elite. The fact that many of the architects of the Balfour Accords themselves were rabidly anti-Semitic and were interested in just using and manipulating and playing with and eventually destroying the Jews for geopolitical effects was also not a coincidence. And here I'm referring to people like Lloyd George of the Roundtable Movement that played a big role in that. But I would just, before the break, pointed out the issue of Nazism and the Bank of International Settlements as the central bank of central banks that was largely managed by the Bank of England's Montague Norman, who oversaw the growth of Nazism and fascism as the strong arm response to the Great Depression that was itself instigated in the 1920s across North America and Europe as a great economic miracle solution to everything. And that would put, you know, make trains run on time and give people jobs. Mussolini, Hitler especially, and especially Hjalmar Schacht, Hitler's banker, were cultivated and deployed by Montague Norman vis-a-vis the Bank of International Settlements that ensured that the Nazi machine would grow. There's a very strong movie called The Banking with Hitler that I cite in my article. And so the Nazi phenomenon was something which has been very misunderstood. We've been, you know, we just passed Victory Day on May 9th. And it's a bittersweet celebration over the fact that, you know, we defeated fascism and never again. The fact remains that most of what caused fascism to emerge, and here I'm referring to the City of London, these international banking networks in Wall Street and specifically in London, were never punished. Those who incubated, cultivated, and financed Hitler before and during the war not only were never punished, but went to work at reconstructing their attempt to create a fascist world order with a eugenics priesthood for the managerial class above the masses, above the plebs, in the post-war age. And on top of that, many of the leading Nazis themselves, the unreconstructed Nazis and Italian fascists and Japanese fascists, were simply absorbed into the Anglo-American security complex, with NATO managing things like its secret armies of Gladio that were revealed in the 90s. So the crown, bringing that back into this, played a big role. Prince Philip was one of the key figures who worked with former Nazi SS officer, former Nazi officer, Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, in creating the World Wildlife Fund for Nature. And Prince Bernhard, 6 years before setting up the World Wildlife Fund, that was co-run by British eugenics president Julian Huxley and Philip Mountbatten, had created the Bilderberger Group in 1954. The Bilderberger Group was grown out of the Bilderberger Hotel as an organizing committee for these globalists to work and coordinate annually as one of the keynotes to manage the undermining of the sovereign nation state system, the re-implementation of what Julian Huxley outlined in the founding documents for UNESCO that anybody can read. Just Google Julian Huxley, UNESCO, its principles and philosophy in 1946. And you could read with your own eyes in the first 20 pages, his outline for the need to focus on the young who are being born after World War II, what we today call the baby boomers, and organize the minds of the young to recognize the need for world government and rebranding eugenics, which he calls the queen of all sciences, the science of population control and management of the better and worse breeds under a new name, because Hitler made this word disgusting for many and unpalatable. So he calls for making the unthinkable once again become thinkable. Now, Julian Huxley, on top of being the godfather of the environmentalist movement, having founded the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, and then World Wildlife Fund to raise money for the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, along with Prince Philip, he goes and coins the term transhumanism itself, which takes on a variety of facets throughout the next 50 years. Now, Prince Philip is somebody who's a rabid Malthusian. He's trained in Nazi schools. He follows the thinking and teaching of his uncle, King Edward VIII, who's the Nazi king who called for, you know, Hitler to keep bombing Britain so that you could break the will and bring Britain back to the original plan that they'd agreed to before 1936, which was a global world order co-managed by Hitler, Mussolini, and the Anglo-American fascists, those who had tried to kill Franklin Roosevelt twice, overthrow him, Roosevelt with a banker's coup under Smedley Butler. Those same Wall Street, J.P. Morgan fascists who are funding Hitler, who are funding, providing the industrial support that that the Nazi machine required to carry out the war, the DuPonts, the Rockefeller Standard Oil machine, the J.P. Morgan, the Harriman banking family of Brown Brothers Harriman with Prescott Bush, and that whole network was supposed to co-manage the world order. So the king, Edward VIII, who was taken down because there was a bit of an internal battle within the British aristocracy over whether or not we continue with that plan or whether we abort, because Hitler is starting to become a little unwieldy and is starting to get ideas that he can be the senior partner instead of being the junior partner of the world order. Some of them, like the king, were happy to go along with this new strategy. Others, like Leo Amery of the Roundtable Movement, were saying, well, rather let's abort this. We screwed up. Let's try to fight another day. And that is the grouping that ultimately ended up coming out on top, having finally gotten rid of Neville Chamberlain, the other Nazi prime minister, and they brought in, you know, people like Churchill, who was a little bit less obviously pro-Nazi, though Churchill was a fascist and was a genocidalist who killed 3 million Indians and knew that he did it in order to preserve the British Empire. And so Philip was one of these creatures trained in a Nazi eugenics school who carried out what he was trained to do. In his later mature years, working with these other eugenicists like Bernhard and like Huxley. He worked with Maurice Strong as the president of the World Wildlife Fund for Nature, Prince Philip here. And in that function worked very closely with Maurice Strong, who co-founds the World Economic Forum with Klaus Schwab, another person with some strange Nazi connections in his own family, and is trained by Henry Kissinger in Harvard, a CIA-run program. So Maurice Strong is somebody who is another devout Malthusian, who was the vice president of the World Wildlife Fund in the 1970s, overseeing the paradigm shift that was designed to move humanity away from the ethos that we should defend human beings from empire, and towards the idea that no, the new ethic should be to defend nature from humans. And anything with this new green ideology that really came to the fore after 1968. The idea was, you know, well, everything humans do when we act upon nature by building a dam or doing anything that is supposed to alleviate the burdens of that are suffered by humanity, of starvation, of poverty, is going to always be destructive to nature. And we have to find a way to create a new philosophy of scarcity and adaption to scarcity instead of creating abundance through large-scale infrastructure and scientific progress, which is what form this new eugenics took. And the idea was never to preserve nature whatsoever. I mean, these people like Mountbatten, Prince Philip, Prince Bernhard were always big game hunters who were happy killing white rhinos for their pleasure. They don't care about those things. They were always working with Shell Dutch Oil, John Luden, the second vice president or president of World Wildlife Fund for Nature in the 1960s, was the CEO of Royal Dutch Shell, one of the biggest so-called polluting companies of the world, which was also managing the World Wildlife Fund and growth of the conservationist movement. So, I mean, they don't really care about protecting nature or anything. What they care about is control and finding ways of getting people to control ourselves through guilt, shame, fear that we're a virus. And Prince Charles picked up the family tradition, becoming the president of the World Wildlife Fund of Britain in the 1990s, which he maintains to this day as president. He is the radical activist, eco-activist, eco-crusader king who has devoted himself to the cause of protecting nature from humanity. He's open about that. He was assigned the role of ushering in the Great Reset, which he did as part of his Sustainable Markets Initiative, which itself is an outgrowth of the Davos crowd, and also, you know, things like the what Lynn Forster de Rothschild has been assigned as a former Epstein girl herself. Lynn Forster de Rothschild was married into the Rothschild family and has been used by these kooks occupying the seats at Davos to create the what's called the Council for Inclusive Capitalism, with the Vatican, which has enmeshed itself with the Vatican as part of the idea of creating a new green value structure for capitalism in a post-Great Reset age, which will value putting monetary incentives on activities economically, which will reduce the human population through building things like windmills, solar panels, electric cars, other things that will ultimately, or just doing nothing. If you own land and you do nothing with it, you will get financial incentives from various captured governments that are going to be induced to give now new digital credits to owners of property to do nothing with the property rather than, let's say, build a dam or do something that pretty much everybody in all of human history for thousands of years before this like moment valued was economically smart, which is, you know, make good things happen with resources, develop. They want to get rid of that, crush that completely. So again, Charles just finds himself and the whole crown institution, the crown agents find themselves all over these different branches of the new empire.
You haven't mentioned the queen.
No. I could. I mean, I in the sense that I think she died, and I think she was a much more disciplined person. She's a much more, I believe she was, you know, you look at the type of lazy tongue that Prince Philip exhibited throughout his life of, you know, let's kill the savage jokes. let's call the human herd jokes that he couldn't help himself.
Let me rephrase my question. How intertwined was the queen? Because as far as I can tell, her history was very clean.
Oh yeah. She really, like I said, she was very disciplined herself. I think she took her position as the empress, the hereditary empress of the system, very seriously. She spoke very carefully. She ensured that, I think she respected her handlers, the people who managed her her persona. She did that very very competently. I don't think she was at all a good person. I think she was she just took the position very seriously. I think maybe she was actually embarrassed perhaps by the antics of Epstein, you know, her Prince Andrew, who the whole family is degenerate, and probably her own husband, Prince Philip, is out there rocking it with the Rolling Stones, you know, and people like Jimmy Savile, who's just partying it hard throughout the 60s, 70s, 80s, all the way till Jimmy Savile's death. And for those who don't know, this is a rampant necrophiliac pedophile who was provided the honor of being knighted by the Queen in the 90s. Who's a very close confidant of Philip and a mentor of Prince Charles. And as soon as this guy dies, the floodgates open for the thousands and thousands of victims of his assaults, of his sexual molestation over decades. He ran the top of the pops. So, I mean, you got all of these like pedophiles, creeps that are revolving around the Queen, whether or not she also is a deviant. In this, I have seen no direct evidence. She was certainly perfectly fine covering it up. Again, how she felt in her heart of hearts, I have no idea. No clue.
Yeah, I'm looking at the time and I'm about to open a can of worms for you, but I think I'm wondering now if we can go to an early break, because this might be a... Can we do it? All right, Alex says we can go. All right, let's do this, and then you're going to come back with Diana after the break, Matt. My name is Jim. This is TNT Radio.
De-weaponizing weather with reality and perspective.
We have a very serious situation developing in the Bay of Bengal. A tropical cyclone is developing there. And it looks to me like it is going to head later this week right for the mouth of the Ganges. And that is an area that is legendary for the most severe tropical cyclones and storm surges on the planet. And it appears this is going to become a very powerful tropical cyclone with winds well over 100 miles an hour and a massive storm surge later this week. This is TNT Climate and Weather Watchdog meteorologist Joe Bastardi asking you to enjoy the weather. It's the only weather you've got.
Good night, Mira. Good night, Winder. Good night, Dole. For thousands of women and children in Australia, their car is their home. Help make a real difference to their lives. Donate to the Vinnies Winter Appeal at vinnies.org.au or call 13 18 12.
Good night, Mummy.
Jeremy Nell on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, Matt, here we go. Diana, now this one is always an interesting bit regarding the crown.
Yeah, shoot. The crown killed her. And I mean, that's something which most even people, like subjects living in Britain, acknowledge as sort of an open truism by and large. But it's something which it's just one of these mental dissonances that people kind of live with. And it's psychologically, I find fascinating that almost anybody at any bar and would pretty much admit, yeah, the royal family killed Diana. But then it's like, what do you do with that information? How does that change almost everything you're thinking about? You know, it's kind of like when you hear people say, oh yeah, 9/11 was an inside job. And it's almost like a piece of trivia that most people I know think that on varying degrees, or at least that the official narrative is bunk. But then it like, that should cause you to go into a crisis and think differently about everything else shaping your world. Cause that, you know, so it's a big deal. The best documentary I ever found, that I ever encountered on this topic was called Unlawful Killing, which, anybody can Google this documentary from 2011, that conducts it's directed by Keith Allen, and, it's thorough. It was shown at the Canes. It's harder to find nowadays, but I think somebody uploaded onto YouTube again recently. And it demonstrates a whole bunch of not only anomalies, but from Diana herself writing open letters before she dies, saying that if I die, it's going to be because my car's brakes are going to be messed with by Prince Charles. She's openly saying these things. She, you know, the actual management of the crash, both the execution of the crash, which seems to have involved some elements of French intelligence and MI6 or MI5 together collaborating. The cleanup of the crash involved some weird anomalies, like, you know, the ambulance taking the most circuitous drive to the hospital, like 15 minutes away, and it took them like hours to get there, waiting for her to bleed out. She was, you know, likely impregnated as well by Dodi Al-Fayed. Dodi's father plays a major part in this documentary, going through his research as well. You know, and I mean, think she was just a good person, you know, like she was somebody who had a conscience. She was a school teacher, she was from an upper crust family, but she was still a school teacher, a good human being. And I think she started realizing pretty quickly what it was that was behind the destruction of living standards in these war-torn regions of Africa and around the world. And she quickly recognized the connection to what was in her own family environment. And she, I mean, I used to volunteer with an organization called the Schiller Institute, which had a magazine called Executive Intelligence Review. And one of the investigators who wrote a lot of reports on this, named Scott Thompson, had spoken about a special report in 1997 that EIR had put together on the various imperial dynamics of the House of Windsor, some of the most ugly abuses. And he sent a copy of this 300-page report to Diana and scanned and shared the letter thanking him for sharing this report by Diana's assistant, who wrote and thanked him for sharing this material. So Diana was astute. She was very aware. This is actually 1995 that he sent this. And so I think for a variety of reasons, she had to be eliminated. She wasn't going to keep silent about a lot of these abuses. She was also going to produce somebody who was technically legally going to be the heir to the throne, who might have been a Muslim child. That was unacceptable to the empire, even though the empire tries to pass itself off as though it's pro-Muslim. It's really just pure lipstick. It's kind of like the British monarchy found in the Brooks Book of Peerage back in 1984 that, oh, there's actually a connection between Muhammad and the family lineage of the Saxe-Coburg-Gotha line that became Windsor, putting Queen Elizabeth as a distant cousin of Muhammad. Now, they did this as part of a marketing campaign to enmesh themselves ever more with the Saudi royal families that themselves were installed there earlier on by the British. But they ultimately were willing to always blow up Saudi Arabia and annihilate their Saudi project at any point, which is also why the Saudis are finally realizing how expendable they are and unessential they are in the grand scheme of things. And it's the same thing for the British, who acted like, oh yeah, they're so pro-Jewish. They love the Kabbalah. They love, you know, the queen and the royal family is part of what's called the British Israelite cult, that actually believes that they're part of the lost tribe of Israel, that itself is connected to the family of Jesus, who had a kid with Mary Magdalene, and the Queen Victoria, and all of these bloodlines are all heirs to the bloodline of Jesus. They actually believe some of this crap that they create, which is absurd. I've seen no reason to believe that Queen Elizabeth or Prince Charles don't believe that either. We know that Victoria certainly did. I think her progeny also believe that. So I'm saying all of this just to get across that, no, Diana was somebody who didn't adapt well to insanity and was definitely going to be a problem. So they had to eliminate her.
Are you saying that she knew stuff? Or was she just oblivious?
Oh, no, she knew stuff. No, she was too smart. She definitely knew what was going on. To what degree? To what degree she knew about all of the ins and outs? No, I don't know about. But she definitely knew that there was dark evil going on all around her.
I saw a handwritten note on Twitter. I don't know if it's legit, but someone said that it was her handwriting. You could see that. Well, the note basically says, "My life's in danger."
Oh, that's real. Yeah, she is this the same note where she wrote to, I think it was her psychiatrist or a friend, describing yes. how she fears that the royal family's trying to kill her and manipulate yes. her car brakes. Yeah, that's something which has been validated. Yeah.
Sure. So basically toe the line. Now, with that in mind then, Matt, shame, I really, really, really feel for Kate. Is she now another type of Diana figure?
I don't know. I don't follow the psychology of. It seems to me like Kate and William are a little bit are pretty into, from my distant looking on vantage point. And again, I'm not that much of a follower of the royal family's ins and outs. I think she's a little bit more into it. I haven't seen any evidence that she's as moral and as righteously indignant as Diana was about the circumstances that she finds herself in. Though I could be wrong, and I hope I am. Would be nice to find some more dissonance within the inner circle. William seems to be pretty disappointing, and he does seem to increasingly exhibit characteristics of a Malthusian depopulation fanatic, having given speeches that I've seen transcripts for promoting the idea that we're overpopulated, that we have, you know, he's working with Conservation International and other organizations as part of the depopulation scheme. So I don't think William is too troubled. Yeah, he seems to have really liked Prince Andrew, his uncle, and has partied in his villas and his weird, sex parties over the years. That doesn't give me any comfort. Though Harry, I think everyone kind of knows Harry is not the legit child of Prince Charles. I mean, you know, just the science of genetics. You can't pass on the kinds of character traits of being a redheaded kid from somebody like Prince Charles. You just can't do that. And there is a lot of evidence that Diana did cheat on Charles with a certain polo player. Whose name is escaping me, who all but admitted when you listen to interviews that they were having this affair, that they loved each other, but he was basically, he had this polo player had his life threatened at a certain time if he continued this this journey with Diana. But this is at the same time that she found herself pregnant with Harry. So I think that's part of also the scheme to have Harry removed from the royal family, you know, give up under a certain story, kind of like a story that was concocted with Edward VIII to tell the plebs, you know, he wants to get married to this American debutante and thus abdicate the throne. of course, the reasons are a little bit different in this case, but it's a similar thing. They have to come up with a dramatic story to tell the gossipy plebs why something has happened. But ultimately, I don't even trust Harry that much. I think that him and Meghan are also playing a bit of a dangerous game as a false control opposition. Pardon? Theatrics, yeah. And I think that, you know, Meghan Markle has a lot of connections with the Clinton Foundation, the Clinton clan. And I think that they're sort of trying to set up a form of new love of the monarchy without calling it such as part of a campaign that might see Meghan Markle being set up as a political figure in America, bringing in a new restoration of the monarchy in a circuitous way, in a recaptured USA, as outlined by Cecil Rhodes in his manifesto in 1877 that set the groundwork for the Rhodes Scholarship and roundtable movements that became the CFR, the Council on Foreign Relations, and all of their international hives run by Chatham House. But Cecil Rhodes called for the reabsorption of the American colony back into the fold as part of the global restoration of the British Empire as a one world government based on a eugenics religion. So I think that, yeah, this could be, it fits that design very much to charm the Americans who still, you know, with this Harry Meghan defiant couple story. I don't buy it though.
So we have a little under 10 minutes. So you're going to have to bring me in for a landing. It's a hell of a complicated web. So basically I'm asking you to simplify the whole thing for me somewhat. Come on, Matt, you can do it.
Yeah. Okay. Sure. Well, I think that people need to put back into critical questioning the assumptions that have been given to us as truisms after World War II, which is that the British Empire became the American Empire, that there is no such thing as the British Empire. It's now the Commonwealth of Free and Democratic Nations, and now it's the American Empire that has been the problem for the past 80 years. And sure enough, no doubt, America has acted much of that time as an empire, but not because of anything in traditionally American or constitutional, but rather by virtue of the killing of the American presidents who stood up for the authentic traditions of America's revolutionary history, like John F. Kennedy, like Bobby Kennedy afterwards, like Martin Luther King, two men who were not president but had the moral qualifications and moral power of a presidency. And Bobby Kennedy certainly would have become president had he not been killed by an MK Ultra operation in 68. Franklin Roosevelt, another figure who stood up against the empire and died under very mysterious circumstances in 45, who never would have allowed for the British Empire to create a special relationship. He openly despised the British Empire and wanted to annihilate systems of colonialism. Franklin Roosevelt, unfortunately, the deep state that he fought against for 12 years while president, took over very quickly before his body was even cold, and immediately purged the U.S. of its patriots, from intelligence, from academia, from government, and you know, created things like the CIA and the Anglo-American special relationship, and dropped bombs needlessly on a defeated Japan. Whether people think that they're nuclear or other, it was an unnecessary destruction of Japan that was designed to really set a new threatening tone for how the world order was going to work, instead of it being a China-Russia-U.S. alliance as Franklin Roosevelt and his allies in China and Russia had envisioned, creating a structure of internationalizing the New Deal for the world. Or before FDR, you had, you know, people like Lincoln admiring President Warren Harding, who fought the League of Nations itself, a roundtable Milner orchestrated organization to establish a world government and eliminate nation states after World War I. This was defeated because specifically of the valiant fight of true American patriots like Warren Harding and his network of bipartisan nationalists who fought against this, as well as certain people in Canada and Ireland and people in Russia and China, who fought to make sure that this didn't become the one world, new world order as envisioned by H.G. Wells and other fanatics. McKinley, Garfield, Lincoln, America has a very different tradition, and the fact that it became infiltrated by this British-directed fifth column that has always operated through one of its core basing of operations of Wall Street to take over control of the U.S. and force the U.S. to betray its freedom, its genuine anti-imperial roots, becoming a branch, a dumb giant of the empire. In many ways, the way the Nazi machine was designed to be the dumb giant enforcer of a banker's dictatorship from above. That same role was then given over to the United States over the dead bodies of these great presidents. And to this day, I see that there is a fight of an authentic America expressing itself in the better part of the Republicans who are anti-neocon, tend to be pro-Trump, as well as the better Democrats who tend to be anti-neocon, anti-Obama-Clinton fanatic freaks who tend to be more pro Bobby Kennedy Jr. And these are humans who are authentic, who want to revive their true traditions as an anti-war society, and want good relations with Russia, with China, and other countries that want to survive the oncoming efforts to depopulate the world under a controlled demolition. So I think that has to really become front and center in the minds of people around the world, and especially Americans who realize that there's this other America that is not empire, that the British Empire was not what you thought it was. There's a good Britain. You know, Jeremy Corbyn represented, I think, one of the better dynamics of the authentic, freedom-loving British tradition. But unfortunately, there's this other, more powerful evening, this Hellfire Club Britain, that took over in the so-called Glorious Revolution of 1688. And this thing has been running roughshod over the peoples, the liberties and the freedoms of the world, including of British people themselves, who have been abused massively by the existence of this parasite in their own society, who have to throw this thing off at some point. And with that, I think would go the institution of hereditary structures. And as far as maybe we could talk about this another time, but as far as democracy versus monarchy, I mean, I'm a fan of meritocracy. The big problem with monarchy in my mind, and there have been good kings throughout history. I've got a small list of them. It's a small list, but they're there. But the problem is the hereditary structure, as far as I could see, and that the idea that the moral virtue of a father will necessarily pass on to his children is no guarantee. And often it's the opposite is the case. So the idea of you have to earn, as I think you pointed out, you have to merit the right to be a ruler, and that requires, I think, a more authentic culture that cherishes goodness and truth over mediocrity and corruption, the way ours does, and most of human history does. And then you could maybe have a monarchy that works, maybe with a voting system, perhaps with a smart population who has some role in judging or having some control over whether this person who wants to be the king is deserving of the kingship or not. There has to be something that is there to control that and make sure that it's not some hellfire freak or something, you know, like a Charles.
I'm an anarchist. I'm an anarchist monarchist. I'm opposed to the state unless I am the state.
Well, we the people, right? We the people. America was never supposed to be a democracy, and that was always seen as the flip side of tyranny, is the rule of the stupid. Or the tyranny of the stupid was always what democracy was recognized to be by the founding fathers, and they knew it was supposed to. It could only work as a republic, which is not the same thing as democracy. It involves a cultural component which requires a smart and moral people. Like John Adams said, you know, that this type of society is only good for a moral and religious people, and is fit for no other type. So if you don't have that type of cultural standard, it won't work. It can't work.
Matt, time is very quickly against us. You've got 30 seconds. How can I follow you?
CanadianPatriot.org. Buy my books. I mean, if people want to dig more into it, buy my books. Clash of the Two Americas, Volume 1 to 4, and Untold History of Canada, Volume 1 to 4. It's all there on my website, CanadianPatriot.org.
That was good enough. Thank you, Matt. You know so much. During the break time, Alex and I were chatting, and we decided we're going to call you Matt GPT.
Oh, please don't. That's pretty funny, though.
can type in any question. Can type in any question, and you'll answer it. All right.
I'll answer. Whether I'll have the right answer or not is another question. All right. Take care.
Thank you. Thank you, sir. Thank you for joining me in the trenches.
See you guys.
All right. I'm definitely going to have Matt back. Thank you, Alex, for helping me throughout the show. I'll see how I feel tomorrow. If my guest talks a lot, I'll be fine. I do enjoy listening and learning. George Larson is up next. Send me an email, germwarfare@tntradio.live. My name is Germ. This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.